pop quiz hotshot, two architects, and a man who dabbled in cross-dressing walked into a podcast.
Is this as bad of a joke as it sounds like?
Better. What if I told you that Brigham Young is the connecting thread of all their stories?
How does that possibly make it better?
What if I told you it involves my kids' elementary school?
Hold on. I know Mormonism is a small pond, but this is getting ridiculous and possibly illegal.
And my junior high? And the Huntsman Center?
Go Utes.
What if I told you it involves the most delicious local gin?
Okay, you've jumped the shark at this point.
Stay with me. The tapestry will come together like...
Carol King song?
Exactly.
Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners, from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
Hey, Lindsay, I had something to ask you.
Yes?
Well, it's just... No, I don't think you'd be interested.
What is it?
Well, there's this new book from our friends at the University of Utah Press. It's about a midwife. It has her interactions with fundamentalists, her shifting views on her Mormon upbringing, and I don't think it's for you.
It sounds like it's exactly for me.
All right, well, maybe you're the demographic. Lori Renkel was 16 when she helped deliver her first baby. I witnessed the entire universe unfold at my feet, she writes in Desert Birthright. Later, working as a hospital doula, Renkel observed firsthand the suffering inflicted upon birthing women by male-dominated Western childbirth practices, from casual racism to unnecessary and non-consensual procedures, including the dreaded husband stitch. After a traumatic labor and delivery of her own, she decided to take back woman-centered childbirth and start a home birth midwifery practice. Desert Birthright traverses 25 years of midwifery, often in fundamentalist polygamous circles, weaving together birth stories with childhood memories as Renkel grapples with her shifting Mormon faith. Her poetic voice shines. A placenta becomes the tree of life, the folds in a baby's arm, layers of sand in the desert. Desert Birthright is a deeply personal story of life, death, and modern womanhood in the rural Southwest, and of one midwife's journey of faith, self-discovery, and liberation in the face of adversity. Desert Birthright, a midwife's memoir by Lori Renkel, new from the University of Utah Press. Check them out at U of U Press, and because they're solid people, use code SUNSTONE35 to get 35% off everything on their site. Tell them Lindsay sent you. This episode start. Like every good episode does, with a late night message from Lindsay, hey, did you know, blah, blah, blah. I was hooked. It's not hard to pique my interest. It started with a question about elementary schools, which is not how these rabbit holes start normally, but here we are.
If you saw what was in mine and Brian's chats, there's like three people on earth that could follow most of it. But yeah, we were talking about, I remember this exact conversation because... I don't even know how it started for me. What was I working on at the time?
That's a good question, actually. You found the history of being, and there was, I think there was like some...
I'm just trying to think of how I got in this rabbit hole. This is what will happen. We both are working on a project that is getting us actually paid, right? So Brian and I are working on those. And then we see something on those projects and we're like, huh, I wonder what that is. And we chase that rabbit hole down till we're in Alice in Wonderland, La La Land. And next thing I know, I'm like, hey, Brian, do you know the origins of elementary schools in Utah and the architect behind them? Yeah. Okay. Here we are. But we talked about the school. So let's step back a generation and talk about one of the more legendary characters involved, particularly in the post-Mormon world.
Is this where the djinn comes in?
Actually, yes. First, let's talk about Brigham Morris Young, which was the thing I was researching. That's right. Madame Petrini. That's how this all started.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, I thought we were talking about the djinn.
We are, because occasionally his stage name was...
Okay, there we go. His stage name was Madame Petrini.
One and the same. Brigham Morris Young was born in Salt Lake City in 1854, and his father was... Brigham Young.
Sorry, what was that?
I said Brigham Young, and to the listener who gave us a one-star rating for not being able to separate our biases, me telling you that I don't like Brigham Young is actively separating my biases for you, reader. That's how it works.
I'm sorry. All I heard was blah, blah, blah. I have game.
Stop it. Listen, we can do this one of two ways, Brian. We can talk more about Brigham Young, or we can talk about not Brigham Young.
I have the following to say. I have a statement. I mean, no, not a statement. It's something of my own free will and choice. And no, there is not a firearm pointed at my face currently. I feel like that we should talk about people who had game. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you for making the right choice. Yes, fine. He was Brigham Young's son. Poor guy. But let's talk about his mom for a minute. Margaret Pierce was born in a fairly small town in Pennsylvania named Aston. And if you're thinking, I swear someone else prominent was born from around there, I have two things to say. One, yes, Edwin D. Woolley and Edward Hunter lives close by. And two, bullcrap, no way you were thinking that.
Listeners, we love you. If you truly were thinking that, then we're sorry. Like their sort of neighbors, the Woolleys, the Pierces were also Quakers. It is Pennsylvania. However, that didn't mean that they weren't, you know, DTC.
Do I even want to know what that acronym means?
Down to convert. Get DTC? Your mind out of the gover.
DTC. Gover. You can use that, guys. Missionaries. Are you DTC? Don't. You sound like a predator. Don't.
Yeah, get your mind out of the gutter, people. Margaret tells a story of missionaries coming to their house when she was a kid. Well, the way she tells it, she's a kid, but she's actually a teenager. She had been sick for months, and they said they were directed there. They bless her. She's healed. Just your periodic reminder that charismatic spiritual gifts are one of the hallmarks of early Mormonism. Maybe your snuff-right friend was right all along.
The way she tells it is so delightful. Just listen, quote, "When the doctor last called, he left some medicine which was for a last remedy. At seeing me up, he was greatly astonished and said that medicine was really effective. Whoa, said my mother. She has not touched your medicine, but has put her faith in God. When the doctor heard this, he exclaimed, what? Have the Mormons been here? And now I am DTC.
I like a good vintage whoa. The elders left so quick, the Pierce family had no idea who they were, their names, or even what this fancy church they were from was all about. And I will say...
it's a little bit suspicious.
It smells a little bit off. What missionary worth his salt doesn't use this to not only get in good with this family, but like the whole town? So, setting that aside for now. Missionaries would come back. So if you remember back to the early Nauvoo period when Joseph Smith and friends go to Washington to yell at the president.
Yeah. And he told them, my dudes, I see what you're saying, but I cannot do a GD thing for you.
Exactly. In fact, I think that you quoted that verbatim, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, but cooler. Yeah. Sure.
So on the way back from DC, they're waiting around. They want to see how much the government would reimburse them. Spoiler alert, $0, no cents. They go through Pennsylvania. They stop in Philadelphia, and then they go to Chester County, home of...
the Pierce family! And they were all very excited to have Brother Joseph in their midst.
What Mormon wasn't?
Again, this is... you guys can use this in your next FTC? No. Fast and Testimony FTM. Fast and Testimony, meaning if you want to DTC, because this is full of spiritual experiences. Margaret says she stayed at their house, and then the next day, Margaret says that he stayed at their house, and then the next day was baptizing day. Joseph even confirmed her mother. I know this is the equivalent of saying your guy was Joseph Smith's bodyguard, but in this case, it seems to actually have happened. What is interesting is that mom makes Margaret wait until spring. Seems like her old illness,
of which she was healed.
Well, maybe it didn't stick. Anyway, Margaret got baptized without cutting a hole into the ice. And, you know, if Joseph Smith baptizes you, I think it's a rule that you have to marry Brigham someday. In 1843, sorry, that wasn't a joke. She's his victim. Did you hear that one star rater? I said she was his victim. In 1843, they moved to Nauvoo, and then a bit of mystery. In an autobiography, Margaret says she married Morris Whitesides when she is 18. Except that she didn't. It was in 1844, less than a month after Joseph and Hiram Smith were murdered. Weird that you would misremember that, because there is a marriage record and it was definitely when she was 21. We're going to give her a pass, however, because it was a traumatic time and the prophet and the patriarch are killed, both of whom she knows. And then just 7 months into their marriage, Morris dies of...
Let me guess, consumption.
Yep, the old TB, the tuberculosis strikes again. The TB was not DTC.
Mama, take this badge off of me. I can't use it anymore. It's getting dark, too dark to see. Feel like I'm knocking on heaven's door.
Poor Margaret is already a widow. Well, cheer up, Charlie. Give me a smile. Things are about to get so much better for Margaret.
I feel suspicious again.
Don't. There's no need to. Pretty soon the sky is going to clear up.
The fact that you keep using lyrics from the objectively worst song in the Willy Wonka is not a great sign.
No. It's all good, because Margaret is about to marry again.
Oh, no. I see where this is going. It's 1846 and?
Yes, Margaret marries Brigham Young. She was DTBY, or DTMBY, down to marry Brigham Young. There we go. If you're a lovely single lady in Nauvoo.
Yes, I know. Brigham will put a ring on it after he locks you in a room. Using Beyonce to talk about Brigham Young is just...
tender mercy?
No.
And Margaret is wife number 20, for those interested in those types of statistics.
Margaret will have exactly one child with Brother Brigham, and not even soon. As you will recall, her first husband, the one she probably actually liked, was named Morris. It will not surprise you then that when the little guy comes along in 1854, he is named Brigham Morris Young. Something that I personally enjoy is that he usually went by Morris Young.
I feel like he also went by something else.
You hush, that time will come. But I love that he was going with the dad he really wish he had, the other guy, the Morris guy. But little BM Young, wait, we probably shouldn't do that. Little Brigham Morris Young was born in Great Salt Lake City in 1854, a lovely time to be alive. You lovely citizens of listener land will, of course, nod with understanding when we say that this year really is the apple of the eye of Brigham Young, or the eye of Hurricane, or Hurricane, as they say. We're sort of in between waves of runaway officials before it gets really Utah warlike, but it's creeping up on it. Jetty Grant is there. That sucks. There's seagulls and crickets and all that nonsense. And if you're wondering if anyone had to play, if he had anyone to play with as a child, don't, because he was welcomed by about 30 siblings with another 20 to go. In other words, if a copy of Alexander Cartwright's Knickerbocker Rules had made its way to Utah, they could have had two baseball teams, each with a DH, with 10 kids in the bullpen. No ghost runners for these young kids.
And then when they got sick of playing baseball, they could have played runaway officials.
Bonobomb.
You got to be W.W. Drummond last time. We don't really know a lot about his childhood. We assume he probably had some schooling. They had teachers there at the Young compound, present-day downtown Salt Lake. Then when the Lion House is completed, we're pretty sure that he and Margaret were one of the families that moved in there. One interesting detail that one of Morris's sons later provided is that the porch on the west side of the second floor was the exercise area. So picture all kinds of vintage crap. Medicine balls, you know, that kind of thing. The best is that Brother Brigham apparently bought a whole bunch of roller skates for all the kids. And how do you feel about that little tidbit, ma'am?
Yeah, it sounds kind of awesome.
What was that?
I said it sounds kind of awesome.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm glad they were pulling taffy and roller skating while my ancestors were starving to death and eating sago lily bulbs. Then in 1873, it was time to call Little Morris on a mission. He went to the land that small Pat... He went to the land that small...
We're at that point in the evening.
No, I don't know how I can say this line seriously, but I'm going to try. He went to the land that smallpox vaccines forgot. If that joke also doesn't land, seriously, what are you doing with your life? Mormons are bad, bad people. Yes, they did. They did do bad things with their smallpox and their big pox. It was time for Elder Young to head for the Sandwich Islands. And this is also the time when he starts to enter the documentary record. We have a few letters from Prophet Dad to him. Does one of them include the phrase, in all your intercourse with men? Well, yes, it does. Are we going to dwell on that? Probably not. Maybe a little.
The letters are actually pretty good. Brigham Sr. tells Brigham Jr. Well, not that Brigham Jr. There's the real Brigham Jr. and Brigham Heber and Oscar Brigham and then Brigham Morris and... Listen, smart guy, you try naming 56 kids. Go on, we'll wait. All right, fine, we'll agree to only call him Morris. Back on topic.
No, we won't. No, we won't.
Well, okay, that's not entirely true.
We will for now.
For now? Brigham tells his son, quote, "It is your privilege to know for yourself God lives and that he is doing a work in these last days and we are his honored ministers. And your calling is to be a teacher to the world. There is no honor or dignity in the power of man to bestow that can begin to compare with this in importance or greatness. It is a high and a holy calling, and if you honor it, you will enjoy constant peace and win the respect of all good men wherever your lot is cast."
It's actually quite nice.
What was that?
I said it's actually quite nice.
I really wish you'd speak up over there. In another letter, he tells Little Morris about his plan to revive the United Order. A very fun topic that we will definitely hit later. His mission is pretty normal. There's no stories wild enough to have been passed down to his children. So that was about that.
After a relatively short mission of just 19 months, Morris was back home. Daddy wasn't about to let his son sit around, however. Wait, I have to call Brigham Young Daddy? No, what?
Yep.
No.
We did a secret listener poll and they all voted for it.
This is what I get with the one-star reviewer gets his karma. It's not happening. His gameless father, Brigham Young, the worst prophet of all time, wasn't about to let the return missionary loaf. He called him, along with a couple others, like soon-to-be apostle John Henry Smith, on a kind of local mission to build up the newly created YMMIA. And for the uninitiated, that stands for Young Men's Mutual Improvement Association, or what would be shortened to Mutual later, which is now a dating app for Mormons. There was a similar organization created for girls as well, the YWMIA or YLMIA, and in both cases they originate with Brigham Young and his family and then spread out, and this would be Morris's first major assignment.
A good morning, little schoolgirl. Can I go home with you? Tell your mama and your daddy.
During the same time, Morris met his love, Celestia Armida. She apparently went by just Armida. Middle names were important in this couple. Was an actress at the Brigham City Opera House. She was also the daughter of Apostle Lorenzo Snow and plural wife Harriet Squires. Oddly, her parents didn't even come to the wedding, writing a letter to Brigham instead.
No shade to theater kids, but a little shade. Celestia is a perfect theater kid name.
And Armida as a middle name?
Nailed
it. No notes. Yeah. And during this time, Morris is slowly gaining some prominence. So he's called as a counselor in the churchwide YMMIA and then called on yet another mission. And while he's back east, he got word that his father had died, but was told to stay at his post.
In an alternate universe where Brigham Young lives longer, it's a world we don't want to live in, it's very possible that Morris keeps climbing the church ladder. While he wouldn't say be secretly ordained an apostle like some of his siblings, don't cry too hard for him, Argentina. When Brigham's massive estate is finally settled, Morris will receive land, stock, etc., valued at 18 grand. And I imagine you might have a couple questions. Was the land fun? Oh, I don't know. Does the fact that the main piece of land was Pioneer Park do anything for you? He would actually sell it to the city a decade later at a substantial discount from what it was valued at the estate and turn it over to the drum circles. Also, if the basic concept of Brigham Young's estate sounds interesting, trust us, it is, and we will definitely cover it.
Unfortunately, Armida lost two babies in a row and her health was not great. And let me think, what is the best way to recover from this? Let's take suggestions from the audience.
Another effing mission for the man.
I think I heard yet another mission. Wait, I thought I asked for the best way. Oh, well, this is indeed.
Maybe our one-star guy has something to say about that, but did the one-star guy be forced to call Brigham Young daddy on a podcast? I don't think so.
The poll has spoken, and we will abide by the dictates of the poll. We agreed. Well, that was indeed the proposed solution. Let's go on a mission again. The Young family packed their literal and emotional trunks and headed off for the sunny Sandwich Islands. By this point, Morris is quickly filling up his Hawaii punch card. Now, this time, I said the Young family, Armida did get to come. And while you might be thinking that Hawaii sounds enticing, taking a small child away from home on a ship, and you also don't have the help at home, headed to the sunny islands was actually going to be just a big hassle, we're guessing that's probably true.
Morris and the kids made it home without smallpox so that Morris could do one of the best employment arcs that was ever witnessed in Utah. He started a confectionery company in Brigham City, and I picture something like Music Man. His daughter, Alice, wanted to attend Brigham Young College, and Mother Margaret had been called to work in the Logan Temple, so they pulled up stakes yet again and made the trek through the canyon.
Then in 1893, the Salt Lake Temple opened, and Morris was given a job. That's right, the very familiar Candyman to Temple Worker pipeline. You know it all too well. He would be a temple worker for the rest of his life. At times, he played the preacher in the endowment drama, and later he was appointed the assistant doorkeeper. Now, we've told you all this to give context to the next part of his life. Because, you see, Morris would later become, let's say, a folk hero. A character that he played, Madame Petrini, has become famous enough that there is even a local gin with that name. So, what can we say about this part of Morris's life?
Brigham City would create quite the art scene for such a small place, and Morris would be at the center of it, even managing their opera house at one point. In 1886, not long after Morris returned from the last mission, we got the first mention of him in character in the news. He organized a, quote, grand dressed character ball and at the theater, and oh boy, it was something. For our story, of course, the highlight is the description of Morris playing, quote, Miss Bridget McCarthy, a fine Irish girl. Now, right there is a good time to point out that this was not as unusual as people today might think. You'll hear talk about Morris as though this was some exotic, controversial, unusual, etc. thing to do. Not so. In fact, at the same event, another dude, possibly a cousin, performed as a colored girl. And if you're wondering, colored? Oh, it's spelled... I thought it was an Irish thing. Well, I mean, the Irish thing was racist too, right? Because right. That was... Yeah.
But it's white, so it's more acceptable.
If you were... thank you for making me say that out along with a smallpox joke. I'm going to get canceled.
And daddy. Let's not forget daddy.
Oh, Jesus. Okay. If you're wondering if this was the extent of the problematic parts, definitely not. Attendees also witnessed an Indian princess, a Japanese nobleman, a patty, and yet another person, likely in blackface, depicting an African-American character.
So, a couple points here. Obviously, racist depictions all across the board are, sadly, par for the course at the time. Morris, playing Bridget, would have been seen as just one more character in this pantheon. So in his book, Same-Sex Dynamics, Mike Quinn argued, quote, Most Mormons recognized no sexual significance or potential in cross-dressing for special occasions. Now, Morris didn't see...
But they do now?
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting to think about what this means. I mean, we'll talk about it more as we go, but that is a very pertinent question here, of course. So Morris doesn't keep a journal, so we're relying largely on newspaper reports for his acting career, and based on that, it seems like he would pull some of these characters out periodically at events like ward parties, and a really interesting one is a birthday party for Lorenzo Snow, who, remember, is also Morris's father-in-law.
So at the Beehive House in 1901, Lorenzo Snow got quite the show. There was a performance on the Aeolian harp by his 8-year-old daughter. Mild tangent. Yes, I know. Snow had an 8-year-old. Wasn't he like 70? No, he was 82 when she was born. Polygamy math. Super healthy. There were many pieces, songs, recitations, etc., but the headliner literally was Morris's performance as what seems to be a new character that he tried out on The Prophet, Madame Petrini. And there it is, the role he would forever be known by. He would sing in falsetto and apparently carry on conversations in character. And of course, this happens after his daddy's death, which is interesting. Apostle Anton Lund described the party in his journal. I thought there was only one step from the sublime to the ridiculous. It was a nice gathering. They seemed to like Madame Petrini's entrance into the world.
However, it is interesting to note that of this performance, the newspaper reporting actually focused on more on his other character, a Chinese impression. This one was such a hit that the audience called for an encore in which he played two Chinese men having a political discussion on a train. The report noted that, quote, he gibbered away in a lingo that sounded very much like the vernacular of the Celestials. Yikes.
Yikes. Honestly, it seems like the Chinese character was the bigger hit rather than Madame Petrini, if you read the sources. And the craziest performance actually came a year earlier when Morris and a friend stopped in at the Beehive House and did the Chinese routine in costume. It kind of became his shtick. According to a news article, no one knew it was them until they came back and spilled the beans. So they dressed up as a Chinese person and did a whole racist impression. So... now, what to make of all of this? If you were to rely on what you hear about Morris and Madame Petrini today, you'd think he was this like LGBT crusader, well ahead of his time, you know, maybe a trans person or someone in drag. That's definitely stretching things. And that's what I went out to search when I, you know, start talking about elementary schools with Brian, because I was trying to uncover those stories and I just couldn't find them. They might be there, but what you do see is you see adjacent people dressing in these stories. You see these racist tropes. One show that I really like is Deadwood on HBO because it shows the interactions and prejudices of the time just come interacting. There was no wokeness. There was no politically correct. That doesn't mean people weren't offended or that these weren't hurtful, but especially in white majority, when you're the prophet's son, you can get away with making fun of people that were more marginalized by you. In fact, that was seen as funny. We call that bullying today. But to point this out as some, you know, LGBT icon is quite not the story. In just one performance, one other dude was playing a woman, a black woman, no less. And this is just one of the many low-hanging types of performances of the era. I would say it was probably an act of more misogyny than anything. Many of these were just sexist and racist tropes. And we should also point out that friends of the podcast, Mike Quinn and Connell O'Donovan, have placed Morris's performances squarely in the context of their times and have discussed them fairly. And we're not thinking of them when we're making these critiques, because, you know, Connell knows his stuff. Connell has brought this into the greater consciousness to show that there was flexibility of gender that we don't really see anymore. This is more the Reddit social media affair that blows Madame Petrini out of proportion as some icon. Part of it is that he was photographed in costume, and the image is worth quite a few words, and he did seem to have a high false Italian soprano.
And there's probably no better barometer of how Morris playing Madame Petrini was seen in his day than looking at Heber J. Grant. So we did a YouTube about him just a little bit ago. So Grant grows up with Morris. So like we talked about in that, his father, Jetty Grant, dies basically at his birth, and Heber will spend a lot of time at the Young House. Grant would later say, quote, Morris has been one of my friends from my earliest recollection. And he saw Morris perform and thought it was hilarious. No more, no less. And Grant is such a prude, especially later on, that if he saw, if he thought there was anything outside Victorian norms in Morris's performances, he definitely would have commented. Now, more importantly, Morris will later die of a ruptured appendix, just like Brigham. Do you also think that he was whacked?
I don't think that Brigham Young was whacked.
Okay. That's
how dare you? I said he got poetic justice. His innards ate him from the inside out. What's wrong?
You're
with
not
that?
Arguing for Hosea Stout, then, just to be clear.
No, I
no
mean,
no squirrels were harmed in this.
No.
Okay.
Now, no. I'm going to leave my trenchant replies to myself about that. But I will say, I do want to say one more thing about Madame Petrini, the idea that he was secretly gay. I think you could point statistically more to his interest in theater and in costumes and extravagant performances as maybe a nod to that. But yeah, I mean, when you look at his kids talking about his family, too, they're like, dad loved my mom. They were home a lot. They spent a lot of time like dancing around the kitchen table. So who knows? Who knows what his sexuality was? Was he a racist performer? Yeah. Was it considered racist at the time? I don't know. Was it appropriate at the time? Seems to be to the white people laughing at it. But yeah, you can decide. We don't want to take away your fun. Brian made a drink tonight with Madame Petrini gin. So we are celebrating.
And the drink was named.
Oh, tell him.
It's the Petrini Martini.
This is his spiritual gift. You guys don't know this about him. Brian can mix a drink and come up with a really good name. He needs to open a Mormon bar. If anyone is listening and wants to conscript him into this business, it is his sacred calling.
Time to get back to where we once belonged. The message that started this whole adventure, because it wasn't actually Morris and Madame Petrini, it was kind of more mundane. Buildings, lots of them. So Morris had a lot of kids. It is the 19th century. One of them got the most Mormon name ever, Lorenzo Snow Young. We're not joking. In fairness, Lorenzo Snow and Brigham Young were his grandpas, so he decided to rebel with a nice touch. He went just by Bing.
Bing. Not too surprisingly, being a temple worker didn't make Morris super rich. As a result, Bing apparently left school to work and help out. And he did come back, though, and graduated from LDS High School at the ripe old age of 22. The Steve Holt of all time, apparently.
Steve Holt!
Bing.
During the next phase of his life, he did what anyone did. He met his future wife and then went over there.
Over there?
Yeah, over there. We're coming over. And we won't come back till it's over.
Over there.
You can hear the song in the back of your head. World War I's on. And for Bing, it was relatively uneventful. He did get shot through the hand, and by the time it healed, the war's pretty much over. He comes home and decides to be an architect. Now, coming from the Young family, this was definitely not a choice out of left field. We'll get there. So he heads off to the Pratt Institute to hang out with, I don't know, Pam Beasley. The family was, like we said, not well off, and it was a loan from Heber J. Grant that made it possible. Remember that Grant is good friends with his dad, Morris.
After a year on the mean streets of New York, Bing came back to his lady, Aline Margetts. And if that name sounds familiar, jazz hands to you, friend. Her grandpa, Phil Margetts, was one of the best-known actors in the first generation in Utah. There is a photo of him as Mr. Tootles. That is just a great vintage gem. Let's just say, I think it's safe to say there were probably some homosexuals in their family. A few years of top-notch education in the East, and then it was time to come back to Zion. Bing reached out to Uncle Willard Young. Listen, uncle in the polygamous world meant basically anyone you met on the street, and asked for a church job. The department involved both Willard and Joseph Don Carlos Young, a half-brother, again in the polygamous world, of his father, Morris. And stay tuned for Don Carlos's story down the road.
Bing showed up with vim and pep and whatever vintage terms he had in his suitcase and read headfirst into what you might call church inertia. Because the old guard at their post weren't real excited about these Eastern-educated whippersnappers waltzing in with their shiny new ideas. To lean on the music man again, anything these church architect people don't have already, they do without. If that sounds like an exaggeration, Bing later said that, when he would present a design for a chapel that he was pretty proud of, Uncle Willard would tell him, quote, "Well, I haven't seen that before. We can't do anything like that." If that sounds like a terrible work environment, I agree. Bing lasted all of 6 months in church employ.
Don't fret too much about Bing, though. There was no shortage of opportunities within the Young family. He soon joined the firm of Young and Hansen. The Young part was Don Carlos Young Jr. Don't worry, we can barely keep all the Young architects straight ourselves. Two early jobs with his new firm were pretty posh ones, at least in LDS circles. They worked on the Washington, D.C. Chapel and the Mesa Temple. And remember, there were only 7 temples, not counting the early ones at this point, so this was even more of a distinction.
Blood may be thicker than water, but family architectural loyalties are thinner than non-family ones.
Come again?
There's a good metaphor somewhere in there. Keep looking. Bing was already on the move a few years later, though. He now teamed up with Edward Anderson and Utah Man. The two of them had each entered a design for the Union Building at the University of Utah at their separate firms before meeting, and now, as a firm together, decided to just copy the format of the firm that had won the contract for the next big prize, Kingsbury Hall, also at the U, and this time, they won. They apparently did a few other things together before this, but honestly, if they're not connected to the U, what's the point, right?
Listen, if we start talking about each project they did, we'd have to create a separate podcast, because there's a lot.
These aren't your grandpa's coins. This is the tale of Mormon lintels, from our buttresses to our dormers.
Okay, you're already in it too much. Let's hit a few highlights, though. An interesting early project was the Granite Tabernacle they did. This is the tail end of the glory years for the big fancy stake tabernacles, so that's cool. And another fun early one was the Salt Lake Airport. Did you know that Madame Petrini's son was involved in that? The first iteration of the airport was Woodward Field. It was very primitive in the beginning.
How primitive was it?
Gravel runway primitive.
Yeah, I'd say that qualifies.
Luckily, Bing was on the case, and finally the airport had a proper main building for administration and somewhere for passengers to actually wait.
But Bing wasn't done with temples, however. Even though Heber J. Grant explicitly didn't believe in the United Order, he did apparently believe in communal architecture. When it came time to start designing the LA and Idaho Falls temples, he decided that rather than doing a contest like they'd previously done, he would just put all of the architects on the job. So all of the ghosts from Bing's past seem to reappear. Here's Hansen from Young & Hansen, Edward Anderson's back, and then a guy named Georgius Y. Cannon. If you're curious if the Y stands for Young, of course it does. He is also a grandson of Brigham Young, so they're polygamy cousins.
If you're also wondering if having 6 architects all with egos trying to get on the same page, figuratively and literally, would work, it didn't. What, the United Order doesn't work? What? People can't work together? What? One member of the board later said they jangled, which I guess was the 1938 equivalent of saying they were real B words to each other. It sounds a little racist. I hope it's not, because I really like that word, jangled, to mean didn't get along very well. It didn't help that church leaders didn't always love their ideas. That fun little experiment ended and Bing just kept on architecting. He and Aline were moving up on the Mormon ladder. Bing began a several decade stint in the Tabernacle Choir while Aline was appointed to the Relief Society General Board. One great family story notes that they now had to put away the face cards and start playing rook with their friends like losers. What a nice Mormon touch.
Another fun job that he gets is to design the DUP Museum, the Daughters of the Utah Pioneers. Daughters of Utah Pioneers. There is no the. Don't get that wrong. I know these ladies. They will mess you up. And the whole thing is an absolute crap show. They keep running out of money. There is a lawsuit over the fact that the DUP got taxpayer money for it, a whole lot of taxpayer money, and this Professional Society of Architects pooped their pants because Bing designed it after the old Salt Lake Theater.
Which is a nice homage to his father, by the way.
Well, yeah, and the Salt Lake Theater was rad.
And his grandfather.
So, yeah, the next time you drive by that museum, which is just up by the Capitol and is rad as hell, that's kind of what the theater looks like.
It's the closest thing we have, because that poor theater was like mismanaged, and then burned down, and then like it's sad. But we don't it was a great, huge part of Salt Lake City. Brigham Young loved it.
And performed there a couple times.
And performed it. Yeah, yeah. It's so cool. Like, the history of that deserves its own episode. And the only remnant we have is the DUP Museum.
So after his colleagues, the architects, crapped their pants, he resigned with his metaphorical middle finger held high to him. There are so many projects. I mean, the list truly is page after page. Bing marched proudly back up to the U. He designed the library and is actually part of the initial plans for what becomes the Huntsman Center, though sadly, he wouldn't live to see it finished.
I feel like there was something else, something you're ignoring.
No, that's it. There's definitely nothing else. There's nothing involving a subpar fight song.
No, I'm sure of it. Something very blue and Utah County-based.
Marriott Center.
How was that?
I said the Marriott Center. Listen, people, we can't all be perfect. The guy is literally Brigham Young's grandson. We can't expect his yell to always ring through the mountains near and far.
Also, wait, I thought you said at the beginning that two architects and a crossdresser walked into the bar.
I did. And here's the sadist part, because Don Carlos, our second architect, will have to wait till later. Friend of the podcast, Brad Westwood, is working on a book about him. And so we'll have Brad on to discuss all things Don Carlos, who is very interesting. Until then, just keep your Chinese impressions to yourself.
I hear the crying of the hungry in the deserts where they're wandering. Hear them crying out for heaven's own benevolence upon them. Hear destructive power prevailing. I hear fools falsely hailing.
Must have been late afternoon. On our way, the sun broke free of the clouds. We count only Books of Mormon's reports, powered by Benchmark Books. All right, friends, this is another one where we don't have a lot of book-flavored things to point you to. So one of Morris's sons did a pretty interesting short bio of him. It's never published, but it's down at the BYU Library, which was designed, quite appropriately, by Bing. And then a daughter-in-law did a similar bio of Bing, which is on FamilySearch, so we'll link to that as well. And if you want to read about O.G. Brigham, for context, the bio, Brigham Young, Pioneer Prophet, written by friend of the podcast John Turner, who has plenty of game, by the way, is never a bad idea. As always, you can get these books, along with everything else in the Mormon universe, at Benchmark Books. Visit Benchmark in Salt Lake City or at benchmarkbooks.com.
And if you want to keep Madame Petrini as your LGBT icon, that's cool. Like, no shade. I think you should be able to do it. We don't want to yuck anyone's yum. We just, as always, have to ruin the backstory with the history.
And if you do find one of those cabinet cards of Madame Petrini, tell me where it's for sale, lend me the money, and then I'll buy it. How, is that a deal?
So the gin is solid. The gin is solid, and as solid as Madame Petrini's Italian falsetto.
All the notes. All of
them. All the notes. All of them. Especially the high ones. My blood upon the earth, oh brother Brigham, brother Young. I beg you, spill my blood, oh brother Young. And let it smoke ascend to heaven, brother Brigham, brother Young. And let my breast be cut asunder, brother Young. As an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, brother Young. A blood atoning for my sinning, brother Young. Cause I sinned so gravely, brother Brigham, brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young. Let only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com and consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.